Welcome to the Weekly Leader Podcast, episode number 23. I'm Peter Mello from Sea Fever Consulting and the founder and editor of the Weekly Leader Podcast and blog. And my podcasting partner, as usual, is Pam Fox-Rollin from IdeaShape. Hi, Pam. How's it going today?
Peter, it's going great. It is sunny in Sunnyvale today.
Excellent.
So all is back in order.
You survived your storms last week.
We did.
Oh, that's good. I saw that Twitter was all a Twitter about your storms out there last week. And I'm glad everything's ship-shape.
It rains in California, and we tweet about it. So we're good.
So let's jump right into it. Something that just happened in the last couple of days that interests me, and it's clearly a developing story. I don't know if you've been following it. The Galleon hedge fund insider trading scandal. You familiar with that at all?
Just a bit. I was hearing an intriguing report about it last night.
Yeah. So, you know, right off the top, we have to say it's one of these things that's a developing story. It certainly is on the front page and beyond the front page, many pages in the Wall Street Journal today and yesterday about the people who are involved. And what just piqued my interest is two people in particular have been implicated in this, according to the Wall Street Journal, and that is a top IBM executive who is actually a CEO candidate and the head, I believe, of hardware in the United States, maybe worldwide, and a McKinsey consulting firm, Star, and they were just both involved in passing and trading information. And again, right from the get-go, this is a developing case, and we don't know how aggressive the prosecution is in pursuing something like this, maybe overly aggressive, so we don't really have all the facts. But it just made me think about people in pretty high-level places and how fragile leadership can really be. And both of these individuals have been, according to the newspaper again, have been put on leave of absence during this investigation.
I'll touch on that theme in the research report of the week.
Excellent.
About the challenges of avoiding temptation.
Yeah, excellent. And then when I was doing some research on this, something else popped in on the New York Times website. I don't know if you're familiar with Bernard Kerik, but he was the police commissioner in New York City during 9/11 at the side of Rudy Giuliani. He became pretty popular, pretty famous, I guess you'd say. And actually was a candidate to be the head of Homeland Security. I think maybe the first head of Homeland Security. Well, he's gone to jail. It just strikes me, again, amazing that people in these high-level situations can find themselves fall so far. He had some conspiracy and fraud charges, I think, tied to tax evasion, and one of the reasons he went to jail is because the judge felt that he needed to be put behind bars because he was a risk that house arrest. So not a lot to say on that, but it certainly just piqued my interest, and we'll be following these stories as they develop. Of course, the head of the Galleon insider trading scandal, the CEO of the firm has, and everybody has, pretty much denied what they've been accused of. So we'll keep an eye on that. Our website of the week is, we're going to try something a little different, and it's not going to work for people who seriously time shift the podcast, although you might be able to find it recorded later. It's a webcast, which will be on Thursday, October 22nd at 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. So what's that make it my time here?
1 o'clock.
Thank you. And it's murder boarding. It's not about the ideas you keep, but the ones you kill. It's an O'Reilly webcast, and you are familiar with the presenter, right?
Yeah. It is my pal Millifer Merchant, who is CEO of Rubicon Consulting. Brilliant strategic mind. Fabulous presenter. She has a book coming out later this year called The New How, and one of the features of the book is, which in general is about getting collaboration in the thinking across your organization. One of the things she talks about is what she calls murder boarding, is kind of the opposite of whiteboarding, where everybody goes up and writes so much stuff, but at the end of the day, you actually have to make a decision. And you have to murder some of your favorite ideas in order to coalesce the organization around the few things that you're going to commit to do. So if you can make that webinar or look for the slides later, she is an absolute fabulous speaker, and she has a wonderful Twitter feed at Millifer, N-I-L-O-F-E-R.
Jim Collins covers it in Good to Great. Saying no, trying to figure out what to say no to is often one of the most difficult things in leadership. So I look forward to to attending this seminar. Looks interesting. Our research report of the week, what do you have?
Well, I have something a little different than I planned because I had one of those NPR driveway moments this morning, and I'm horribly prone to them because I'm so excited about what I'm hearing on NPR that I just it's hard to drive. Good drive I did. So they're actually in the middle of a three-part story. Today's was called Crossed Wires, Flaws in Airline Repairs Abroad. And basically, the data shows that over the past 6 years, there's been a huge increase in the percentage of aircraft, U.S. aircraft, that are maintained abroad. Why? To save labor costs. Clear. So right now, about 20% are maintained abroad. Which wouldn't necessarily be a problem because any U.S. aircraft has to be maintained to FAA standards. So no matter where it's repaired, it has to be maintained to FAA standards, which sounds fabulous, right? However, the oversight of foreign aircraft maintenance facilities is sounding rather dubious. The FAA is supposed to inspect them, but the records aren't there, the data isn't kept. And so NPR sent Daniel Swerdling down to El Salvador to go to one of these aircraft maintenance places, Aeromon, and the executives wouldn't talk with him, blah, 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 blah. So he met the maintenance fellows at their bus stop.
Okay.
And interviewed them. And it's not perfect. It's anecdotal, agreed. However, what they had to say was quite compelling and certainly worth further investigation. So they said things like, yes, our managers tell us this is so important. People's lives are at stake and really impress upon us that what we do has very serious import. So that sounds good. However, often the supervisors say we've got to rush this plane out. You know, we've got a short time window. We've got to turn it around fast. And some of the littler things slip. And the fellow said, you know, so does this happen recently? Have you ever been pressured to do something you thought wasn't 100%? And the person being interviewed said, yeah, last week we were repairing the fuselage, and it was supposed to use a specific kind of high-lock fastener, and they didn't have that kind on hand, so the supervisor said to use another kind. And the person says, well, that might cause a crack in the fuselage, and so we can't do that because the manual says I can't do that. And the supervisor said, well, use the other kind anyway because we've got to turn this plane around. And apparently it happens a lot, that the pressure for time means that corners are cut. And Daniel Swerdling then interviewed a spokesman at one of the airlines where they've at U.S. Airways that uses Aeromon, and the spokesman, David Seymour, I thought at least he would say, hey, that does sound concerning. Let me go check it out. And he basically said, you know, I can't be concerned on the basis of anecdotal comments. So, you know, as someone who flies, it's a little bit scary. And even more so, what this really drove home for me was what we were talking about earlier about temptation, and especially under time pressure. So I have a couple research articles that we'll put up on the – or summaries of research articles that we'll put up on the Weekly Leader podcast notes for this episode. And one of them I know you've seen is a post called How Smart Leaders Talk About Time. And it is from Luca Bijuni, and I hope I am not just totally massacring this professor's name, but he is a business professor at an Italian university in Milan. And he brings up the study that, Peter, you might have heard about, the Good Samaritan studies from the 70s.
Yes.
With the seminarians, these people who are studying to become religious leaders, are told, and this is such a fascinating experiment, that they're going to be asked to give an impromptu speech that'll test their skills in impromptu speech. And the speech will be videotaped in a building at a short distance. They're going to need to walk to another building. So on the way, they've planted an actor who moans and says he needs help and seems to be in some pain and difficulty. Now, the lecture that they're supposed to do an impromptu lecture on is the story of the Good Samaritan, so one who helps others. So presumably they might have some of this on their mind. And some people, some of the seminarians stopped to help, and many didn't. And so they looked to see what were the differences. And it had nothing to do with a separately measured strength of religious feeling. And it had nothing to do on whether they were asked to talk about the Good Samaritan or about something else. However, it seemed very strongly correlated with how much time they were told they had to get to the other building. So there was a group that was told, you still have a few minutes before the speech. There was another group that was told, you're exactly on time. And a third group was told that they were late and had to hurry. And in general, those who thought they had time stopped and helped, and those who thought they were late didn't. Now, if you've got seminarians who are thinking about the parable of the Good Samaritan, not stopping to help somebody who needs help, then you can only wonder about aircraft mechanics being told this plane has to be turned around. So I was just immensely struck by that and had to go back and find this article. They had some prescriptions in here from Professor Biagini and I think they're wise about establishing a language that distinguishes between basically urgency and importance, you know, what Covey is talking about. And be really clear as a leader when things are important but not urgent, that that is communicated. And I find often that, well, one of my professors at Stanford used to say, people schmurgle the two. They combine the two to be crisply clear about this is tremendously important and we have some time to solve it.
Right.
That is indeed the case. The other thing is to proactively look for activities where the time pressure can be reduced, especially if failure is critical. You know, it is tremendously damaging, and what could be more damaging than an aircraft going down because the wrong fasteners were used in the fuselage repair. That really struck me, and it also brought up the other article that we had talked about, which is called The We're the Siren Song, and it is a Kellogg Insight Research summary of recent research by Lauren Nordgren, who's an associate or assistant professor of management and organization at Kellogg School at Northwestern, and some of his colleagues. And what they did was pull together a variety of research that's been done, and I encourage people to read the article. It's a short and clearly written one, that basically said people overestimate their own capacity for impulse control. They call it a restraint bias. And when people are put to the test about their ability to resist cutting corners or engaging in things that are unethical, they're going to be surprised, he says, at how powerful those temptations are. So if you're running a business where failure is costly and you set in place incentives that encourage people to cut corners or in other ways shave on quality, maybe it's a cost pressure rather than a time pressure, and you tell people resist those temptations, people might say, oh, yeah, I can resist those temptations. I'm an aircraft mechanic. I take great pride in what I do. I would never do this. People tend to overestimate their ability to resist that sort of temptation.
So this week we have the second part of Ed O'Malley's interview. He's the president and CEO of the Kansas Leadership Center. It's a civic leadership organization that is funded, substantially funded, $30 million over 10 years by the Kansas Health Foundation to develop leadership in the civic arena in the state of Kansas. So let's hear the second part of Ed's interview.
Thank you.
How are you developing leadership skills for people that the Kansas Leadership Center serves?
We spent most of 2007, which is our first year in existence. My first day was January 2nd, 2007. So we spent most of 2007 obviously building some of the infrastructure that we need to build. We had to find a location and hire some staff and things like that. But we spent most of that year doing a lot of thinking and trying to figure out, you know, what should this thing really become and what is really needed in Kansas and what's really going on in this field of leadership development. So a few different things were happening during that time, and the most significant was we were doing a lot of listening across the state of Kansas, and we were very disciplined and very intentional with this process. And what we were trying to get at was we were trying to paint a very vivid picture of the context of civic life in Kansas, because our thinking was, you know, how could we begin to prepare people to be more effective in civic life if we didn't have a real deep understanding of what was happening in civic life? So it was a great exploration exercise for us, and it really helped give us the bedrock for our organization. It helped, you know, help us get some really firm footing about what we should do and what we shouldn't do, what approaches we should take, and so on and so forth. And there were a few key things we heard which are important in answering your question, Peter. The first thing we heard from people as we synthesized all these conversations, the first thing we heard from people is that the things that concern them the most in civic life are deep, daunting challenges. They're the things that you and I would call adaptive challenges. Now, they didn't have that language, but they described the characteristics of adaptive challenges. So they weren't concerned about little technical things. They had significant concerns, and there were no clear answers to them. And we also heard from people that the way in which communities are currently trying to solve these, what we would call adaptive challenges, is counterproductive. There are only a few people engaging in these challenges, and the great masses are left out of the equation. And it tends to be the usual suspects who are engaging, and there are a lot of unusual voices who aren't at the table. So these are some of the things we were hearing from people. And we also heard very clearly, again, this isn't the language they used, but it's what they said, in essence. It was the music beneath the words. They said very clearly that they wanted us to think of leadership as an activity, as something that happens. And they wanted us to not connotate leadership as authority. And it was really fascinating to hear them articulate those key things. So what we did, and that's a very brief summary of a year's worth of listening, but we used that information and that synthesis to help inform what it is we should help people learn, and then also how we should help them learn it. So through that process was born a curriculum that we use at the Kansas Leadership Center. So we didn't take a curriculum off a shelf somewhere. We could have, and that probably could have been fine. But our perspective was we needed to have a curriculum born out of the Kansas experience itself, out of listening to Kansans. And so out of this effort, we've developed a theory of civic leadership, some core principles of civic leadership, and four competencies of civic leadership. And those three things, the theory, the principles, and the competencies, really are the philosophical underpinning of our curriculum. And if folks are interested, they can go to our website or contact us, and we'd love to share all this information. It's, you know, our theory is it's open source. Whoever wants it can have it. And so that's helped us gain a perspective on what we're hoping to have them learn. And it's all based on some of those key observations that leadership is an activity, that there aren't enough people engaging in it, and it needs to be oriented around how do you do adaptive work. But we also had to figure out how to teach people this stuff. You know, you just can't talk about it.
Right.
It's easy to talk about leadership. It's really hard to help people learn how to exercise different behaviors that would allow them to be more effective when exercising leadership. So we spent a lot of time trying to figure out how do you help people learn this stuff. And that's when actually, Peter, you know, where you and I were introduced to each other was at the program at Harvard, where the case in point methodology was introduced to us, a very provocative teaching methodology that is extremely experiential. And we have gravitated towards that type of pedagogy in all of our programs. And it's, you know, in essence, the approach we're taking is that leadership development, to really help people learn this stuff, it has to be provocative enough to get people into you know, a zone of deep learning. So our programs are very intense. They're very provocative. They're not relaxing retreats for people, although there's a time and a place for relaxing retreats. Those should happen.
Sure.
But our programs are different, and they're very intense, and they're designed that way intentionally.
Now, you have a variety of programs. That are, some are shorter, some are longer. Can you give us a snapshot of a couple of different programs you might be employing over there?
Yeah, you bet. We have 9 core programs, and just to talk about a couple of them real quickly, we have we have one that's kind of our open enrollment program that has folks from all walks of civic life engaged in that program. It's a 5-day intensive residential program, then with a 1-day follow-up several months later. We have another program that is for individuals from faith communities, where churches send teams of people from their church to this program. It's a 6-month-long program with 3 sessions, a 4-day session, a 1-day session, and a 3-day session throughout that 6-month period. And then we have another program, for example, for new legislators right after they're elected. We held that program for the first time after the 2008 election. And that's a 6-month program with 6 or 7 days spread out throughout that time. So all of them are slightly different, but all of them are multi-episodic programs over a long period of time. That's the approach that we've gravitated to.
The open enrollment program, I want to get in that. How do I do that?
People can apply through our website. Mm-hmm. And what's been exciting is that we've had a lot more demand than we can supply right now. So on one hand, that's sad because we have to turn some people away. But on the other hand, that tells us that that people are hungry for this type of an experience. So most of our programs are, you can apply through our website. There are some programs that we're just piloting for the first time, and so we're coming up with pilot audiences and things like that. But our hope is to have all these fully accessible to anyone throughout Kansas through our website and beyond.
Are there costs to the programs, or how does that work?
Yeah, it's another great thing about the situation we're in. We don't charge tuition, and we think we're developing extremely high-quality programs. And our approach has been that these, you know, there's no reason why, with a gift like this to the state of Kansas, there's no reason why Kansas couldn't have the very best in civic leadership development programming. So we're, you know, benchmarking our programs with the you know, Center for Creative Leadership type programs and the Harvard Kennedy School type programs, and we think we're gonna get there. But it's exciting because there's no tuition. This grant allows us to provide these experiences for people at no cost to them. Now, we actually have just recently started charging a very minor, what we call a participation fee. And we're doing that simply because we've learned that it helps for people to have a little of their own skin in the game. Mm-hmm. It's very minor. It's something like $75 or $100. And for a week-long program or a six-month-long program, that doesn't even begin to cover the cost of snacks for the individual.
Yeah.
But it's just a little something to help them have some skin in the game. But by and large, there's no cost. So when people come to these programs, we provide their lodging, their meals, all the materials, no tuition. It's a great gift to the state, which is all the more reason why we've got to get this right. You know, it's very special.
So you're doing so many different things over there, so many different exciting programs. You're a new organization, though, and you know, as you readily admit, you know, you're kind of in a discovery phase, exploratory phase, and how you approach things. But how are you measuring the effect and figuring out if the course you set is a proper course or you need to make a course correction midterm on the journey?
Well, Peter, it is a critical question, and it's one we're devoting a lot of time and energy and resources to. Our experience is that much like there is nothing quite like the Kansas Leadership Center anywhere in the nation or beyond, There has never been an evaluation effort to evaluate something like the Candace Leadership Center, obviously. So we are in major discovery mode when it comes to evaluation, but we believe that we have to figure out how to evaluate this, that we owe it not only to our funder, that we owe it to the people of Kansas, and we owe it to all the different leadership organizations that exist who don't have the opportunity to have a funding source like this. We owe it to all of them as well to figure out how to evaluate what type of difference we can make on civic leadership. And the approach has been really fascinating. We've put together what we call our evaluation team, which is made up of a handful of folks from around the country who are helping us think through how to evaluate this work. So we're putting together some of the best minds in the evaluation world that we could come up with, people like Carl Larson at the University of Denver, and a number of others who are helping us think through these questions. And we are determined to figure out not just some of the qualitative measures, which most leadership development evaluations that I've been exposed to focus on the qualitative or even just the anecdotal type measures. We believe that we can figure out how to measure this from a quantitative perspective and begin to track changes in civic life. Now, we don't know exactly how it's going to happen, but we are determined to figure it out. It's a huge focus of our organization. It's a very large initiative. It's why we have a whole team of people working on it. In fact, we bring that evaluation team together here in just a few more weeks. We tend to come together every quarter or so for a couple days and get these great minds together. It's kind of like a think tank on evaluation of leadership programming. And it'd be really fun, Peter. I'm not sure if this would ever work, but it could be really fun to have the Weekly Leader podcast come, you know, be on site sometime talking with all these different folks, because they're fabulous minds. And it's a tough question. We don't think anybody's quite figured it out quite right yet, and we're bound and determined to figure it out.
Well, we'd love to come out there and talk to you. It must be drawing attention, too, from a lot of people, a lot of other organizations, foundations in particular, who fund, you know, obviously it's nobody exactly like you are, but there are a lot of leadership programs out there that are funded by foundations. So there must be a lot of interest from some of the larger foundations, I would even imagine.
There's some now. I think there'll be even more as we start to be more public with what we're thinking about on the evaluation front and start actually having some things to share that are beyond just the developmental stage. And I think you're right. I mean, my hope is that what we're learning about evaluation of our civic leadership effort could be applied to local civic leadership programs, which there are a lot of local programs that are focused on civic leadership. There's just nothing quite like us that's statewide with this type of resource. But our hope is that this could be really useful to those local programs everywhere, but also to the funders of those programs.
I probably should ask you this right up front, but can you define for us civic leadership? What does civic leadership mean?
Well, we're trying to define that, so don't feel bad that you didn't ask it right up front. we feel we kind of know what it means, but we need to get more clear with how we articulate that. Sometimes we talk about leadership for the common good is another way we refer to civic leadership. And what we mean here is that our assumption is that most of the significant challenges facing our communities, most of the adaptive challenges facing our communities, are the type of challenges that can't be solved by any one sector alone. So the business sector by themselves can't solve it. The education sector can't solve it, so on and so forth. So we think of the civic sector as the place, the civic space as the place where all these sectors come together and attempt, and more often than not, they don't handle it very well, but they attempt to work together to make progress. So we think civic leadership is a kind of a sector-crossing leadership. And that's an important thing to talk about because, we're very specific in that we're not providing training opportunities to help people learn how to be a better manager, for example. That's not what we're doing. While we think that's important, I mean, people need to learn that. Our objective is to help people learn how to exercise leadership in the civic domain. There is no organizational structure, when there are no clear lines of authority, when nobody has authority over anybody else, even from my own personal experience in the legislature, even the governor can't do anything on her own. She is reliant on getting the majority of people she has no authority over to agree with her before she can do anything of significance. And our assumption is that that same situation plays out in civic life, in towns, in neighborhoods, communities, all across the state and everywhere else. And so civic leadership is really about leadership for the common good, and also leadership taking place in an environment where there are no clear lines of authority. We think that's a really big difference between civic leadership and organizational or business leadership, for example.
So let's switch gears a little bit and talk about you and leadership. We talked earlier how difficult it can be about being a CEO of a nonprofit like you are, and it can be lonely in that position, lonely at the top, as they say. So where do you turn for advice and support, and how do you recharge your batteries? And this is particularly, I think, interesting in your case in that you are not only a new CEO, but you got a brand new organization, and everybody seems to be new, and it seems to be an exciting place. But I'm sure with that comes incredible stresses and challenges. So,
yeah, you know, it's tough. I mean, I'd like to say I'm handling it well. That I think some days are better than others, to be honest with you. And a lot of the pressure. Using language from day one like healthy burden, I think is important, but it also just adds to the pressure.
Sure.
And so, you know, what I'm trying to do is to not take ourselves too seriously. You know, one thing that helps is that we always frame everything we do as, you know, our best guess at the moment. And as we learn new things, we'll change. But you got to start putting stakes in the ground. You know, for me personally, you know, I'm doing things like trying to develop kind of accountability and support relationships with other younger CEOs or younger executive directors of nonprofits. And that has been helpful because it is kind of a unique situation to be in. And especially with having a young family and being young in this role, I do think it's helpful to have some other people in a similar experience just to chat with and kick ideas around with and kind of let your guard down. So that's been really helpful to have a few of those individuals here in the state that I can talk with. I'm also blessed with some great relationships elsewhere around the country of folks who are either in a similar situation or know me well enough that they just care about me and they don't really care about the Kansas Leadership Center, and they're great confidants to help me with. And then my spouse is fabulous, Joanna. Really, and what's so great about her is, I think she really appreciates what we're doing, and she is fully behind it. But she helps me keep it all real and not take myself too seriously, which I think is really important. You know, at the end of the day, I go home and I got to change a diaper just like anybody else, and that really helps.
Absolutely. So, do you have a mentor or any mentors?
I do. And I feel really blessed that I've had a lot of fabulous mentors throughout my professional life. And what's helpful is that many of them were mentors for me in the civic realm when I was in the legislature and working for the governor. So, for example, our former lieutenant governor, a man named Gary Scheer, has been very instrumental in my life. Close colleague and former state senator in Kansas, David Adkins, who now is the executive director of the Council for State Governments. He's been an incredible mentor to me. I had a stint at a Chamber of Commerce in the Kansas City area doing government affairs for them. And Mary Birch, a wonderful, insightful woman full of incredible wisdom, has been an amazing mentor to me. So all of those folks and others have helped mentor me back then when I was engaged in, you know, what I think of as the work of civic leadership, actually trying to make things happen in the civic sphere. And they're great mentors now that I'm working on trying to figure out how to develop civic leadership potential in others. You know, what's been more challenging for me is to find those mentors in the field of leadership development. And as you know, Peter, it's still a relatively new field. And compared to the field of economics or something like that. That's been around for thousands of years. But I've been really lucky to do a lot of close work with people like David Crislip, who is, you know, kind of the godfather of the collaborative leadership domain, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. David has done a lot of work with us at KLC and has become a dear friend. And then Marty Linsky as well. I know you've had Marty on the podcast before, I believe, and you know Marty. We've done a lot of work with Marty, and it's been neat to see that transcend from work to true friendship. And I really appreciate how he's helped mentor me as well. So I'm really lucky. Maybe it's part of when I see somebody who could be a good mentor, maybe I just hound them enough that it turns into one.
You mentioned changing diapers. I'm not sure if that recharges your batteries or not, but it probably does, I'm sure. Young children always seem to have that effect on us. What else do you do to kind of get away from it? Are you able to take vacation and kind of break away from this? I know it's a new organization. It's probably pretty demanding, but are you able to kind of distance yourself from it and clear your head?
Yeah. My perspective has been that we've got to take time to get away. So we've had, actually four nice vacations since we moved down here, where we get away for a week at a time. I take a lot of, just single days here or there, just to hang out at home with the kids and Joanna. So that's to me, that's felt really important, and it's getting easier and easier to do that as the organization matures. I love the fact now that we have 55 to 60 individuals. I should have done an exact count before the call started, Peter. But 55 to 60 folks who are all intimately involved with this thing called KLC, and it's so great because I don't feel like I am nearly as important anymore to the KLC idea as maybe I was when there was just one of us, and that's a really refreshing feeling. To know that if I need to step out for a week to recharge my batteries, that I have so much confidence in the other people who are here that great quality work is going to take place. And one of the ways that is manifesting itself is, I used to feel the need to be in every moment of every program at the beginning, and I think that made sense at the beginning, but it doesn't make sense now because it's not needed. We have such a fabulous faculty team. I'm in some programs and I'm not in others, and I don't have any worries at all when I'm not in one. I know great work is happening, and we've got fabulous folks. So all that contributes to me feeling free to step away more often, and not just to step away and work on other things, but to step away and not work on this at all and recharge my batteries and spend time with family and whatnot.
There's a healthy burden in action, I think.
Yeah.
I loved your story about the texting and trying to determine the votes. New communication technologies and social media are really changing the way that we establish and build relationships, as well as how we manage and lead people. And how are you and how's KLC using social media currently?
The main thing we're doing is we're just trying to experiment with everything we can. And we don't really know what fruit will be born from these experiments yet. But we're certain if we keep experimenting, we're going to start discovering good things. So, we have it's an expectation here that everybody in the office is on Facebook. And we joke with people that this is one of the few workplaces where you don't have to minimize your Facebook when somebody walks by. it's okay to have it open. we have folks experimenting with Twitter. We are trying to engage more and more of our participants in social media ways. So our initial thinking is that leveraging things like Twitter and Facebook, just to use those as examples, leveraging those things to enhance connectivity with people who have already gone through our programs seems like a really powerful tool. Now, we also think we could find great ways to use those applications to reach out to people we haven't connected with yet. But we think there's some real potential in the connectivity of our alumni if we can figure that out. But we don't really know what the heck we're doing, to be honest with you. We're just forcing ourselves to experiment. And as we experiment, we learn a lot. We have created a YouTube channel, and we have a couple videos on our YouTube channel talking about some of our programs. And we're anxious to see what happens with that. We started a blog about 8 or 9 months ago that has been very useful and interesting. And so we're just trying to dabble with a lot of different things and make sense out of them as we go. And I think the most important thing we're doing is creating an expectation that we experiment with this stuff.
So your program participants, when they come in, do you find that many of them have experience with these communication tools, or their first experience is through how you kind of relay them to them?
Yeah, I think we're finding probably, and we haven't done a study on it, although it would be easy for us to do. It's probably something that others could get some value out of. If I had to guess, I would say that probably about 50% or so of our participants have engaged in social media or social technologies in some way. So they've been on Facebook or LinkedIn or Twitter or something like that. And for 50%, it's new. And part of that might have to do with the demographics of who we're reaching. You know, our target audience are people who are already engaged in civic life. That was a big decision point early on. That our objective wasn't to inspire new people to engage. It was to work with people who were already engaged. So as you might imagine, we have a little bit of an older demographic. Our average age is probably, of our participants, is probably low 40s, mm-hmm. if I had to guess. So, but it's probably about 50%, I would say. And we have a big program coming up in November, and one of the experiments we're going to run, we'll have about 250 people at this program. It'll be our largest program yet, and it's a three-day program. Folks from 40 different communities coming together. It's going to be really neat. And during this program, we're going to have a Facebook station set up and have it staffed by a couple of our younger folks and are going to be encouraging people to get signed up for Facebook. And our hope is that by having the station set up with laptops there and having people there to coach people through and not make it so intimidating, that we'll get some more people to sign up, and who knows, I'll have to report back with you on how that experiment goes.
That would be fantastic. Yeah, we'd love to hear about that. What books are currently sitting on your nightstand? What are you reading?
A couple different things. One of them is, in fact, I carry my books around with me, which might be a good idea, might be a bad idea. So they're not actually on my nightstand. The ones I'm reading, I just stick in my briefcase, and I take them from my nightstand to my office, to my car, everywhere. So I've got a book called The Lawmakers, which it was written in the 1950s, and it's just about, especially for someone who's been a legislator, it's really interesting. It's kind of dissecting the type of people who go into a legislature, and it's really a fascinating kind of classic book. Reading a book called The Age of the Unthinkable by Joshua Ramo, I think is how you say his last name. Really interesting book, kind of talking about the future and the way things might change. And then have another book. We actually have a book club here in the office with our staff. We choose a book and have a book club that meets every month. And right now we're reading The 5 Dysfunctions of a Team, which is a pretty popular one. You may have seen before. So that's what's on the bookshelf right now.
Yeah. That book came up on our first podcast, I believe.
Really?
Peter Aceto was the CEO of ING Direct. I think that was one that he was reading, or I believe so. Episode one. If you could have lunch, because you're a busy guy, you don't have time to waste here, you only have a short lunch hour. If you had time to have lunch with any historical or contemporary figure to discuss leadership, who would it be, and what would you want to take away from that experience? Could be more than one, even, if you wanted to put a couple people together. But
I think a little group lunch, something like that.
Yeah.
What a wonderful question, and obviously hard to answer. So it's tough. So there would probably be a number of people, but a few that come to mind for me. LBJ would be one, and the reason I'd love to talk with President Johnson was he had a way of getting things done. And I think this whole idea, this belief that leadership is an activity, and the way we talk about it here, it's specifically the activity of mobilizing people to accomplish difficult work. So So in the end, it's about, you know, did you do something? And I think LBJ accomplished so much, and part of it's my political baggage too, just fascinated by what he was able to accomplish in the political realm, mainly before he was president, but then also after he became president. So he would be one that would just be fascinating to talk with. And it's hard for me not to stay away from the political figures because of my background, but Theodore Roosevelt is one that fascinates me. A lot of my politics are similar to his politics, so that would be interesting. But he had a way of going against the flow, which I think was fascinating. And I think it's a part of leadership. I think a part of leadership is being a disruptive force and helping people do things they don't necessarily want to do, and at least initially. And I think he had a unique way of doing that. And now I'm blatantly disregarding the particulars of your question and going well beyond just one or a few. But I think of there's so many different folks from the civil rights movement who would be fascinating. And while a lot of people would love to, you know, have lunch, for example, with Martin Luther King Jr., and that would be fascinating, I would love to sit down with some of the people who were, you know, on the front lines, some of the folks who, you know, were in those marches way back when, some of the folks who, you know, did the sit-ins. One of the things we believe is that that leadership isn't just the responsibility of the, you know, the big charismatic figure, that everybody has the opportunity to exercise leadership at any time, and that making progress on these challenges in our civic communities will really require more and more citizens, without the big titles, more and more citizens stepping forward and exercising leadership. So I would love to, you know, sit down and talk with those folks who decided, yeah, I will go out and march today, or decided that, you know what, today's the day I'm going to do a sit-in. It would be fascinating to know what risks they thought they were going to face, what motivated them. Yeah, I would learn a lot more from those lunch conversations than I would from the ones I mentioned earlier.
You have any advice to some final advice to people who are looking to exercise leadership? How do they do it?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to sum that all up in one final comment, but I think what I would say is that I think one of our challenges, our meaning as citizens, I think one of our challenges is that we think that we can make change happen and have everybody love us at the same time. And I think the exercise of leadership is a highly provocative exercise. And so I would encourage folks to think about that and weigh what that really means for them. There's a reason why leadership is hard, and the reason why a lot of people don't do it. And it's risky, it's full of conflict, and I think it inherently has to be provocative. But it kind of goes against our human nature of wanting things to be calm and wanting to be liked. So I guess those are some final thoughts, perhaps. But
what else would you like to share with us about what you guys do over there and leadership in general? Anything else?
Well, one thing I would love is I'd love to encourage people to contact us. We are, as a new organization, and one that is pretty upfront about claiming that we don't exactly that we don't think anybody exactly has all the correct answers. We'd love to hear from folks, hear your thoughts, your ideas related to civic leadership. We try to be a very open organization that is easily influenced by others. So we are very permeable. So if folks are interested in what we're doing here in Kansas, we'd love to talk with you and learn from you and share what we're learning. And the website provides lots of different ways to get in touch with us and things like that. But we're on this journey, and we know there's a lot we can learn from a lot of folks here in Kansas, but also throughout the nation and beyond. So if this has piqued an interest for anybody, please give us a holler. We'd love to talk.
What is your URL over there?
It makes sense, but it's rather long. But it's simply www.kansasleadershipcenter.org. All that is spelled out, kansasleadershipcenter.org.
And are you on Twitter?
I am on Twitter. You can follow me at E. O'Malley, E-O-M-A-L-L-E-Y.
And you guys have a Facebook page as well. People can become fans of the Leadership Center, right?
You bet. You bet. We'd love that.
Great. Yeah. And all this stuff will be in the show notes. So If anybody's interested, there'll be links there in the show notes. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time, and maybe we can check up periodically to see how things are going over there. You can give us a report about how your different programs are going. It's an exciting new organization that sounds like they're fortunate to have you at the helm and fortunate to have some solid funding in place. And people of Kansas are pretty lucky.
Well, we think we are pretty lucky, and I'd love to keep in touch, Peter, and be great to give an update back on the show sometime.
Enjoy doing these interviews, and I listened to it again today before we came on the podcast, and I was extremely impressed by what Ed's doing over there. What were your thoughts?
I think Ed has the coolest job around. To be able to create with a huge budget a tremendous leadership resource to impact a whole state and the civic conversation in that state, which he defined as cross-sectoral, I think is, you know, a tremendous opportunity, and he sounds up for the job. There were a few things that he said that, you know, that really struck me. I love how he talks about creating a zone of deep learning. And as a facilitator, I'm often asked to come meet with folks, you know, going back to time pressure, you know, let's do this in 2 hours. And great, what do you want to get out of it? And what they want to get out of it is something that really fundamentally means people need to change their mindsets about something and behavior. And does that give us enough time to really create the conditions for deep learning? Part of the facilitator's craft is to have some methodology for creating deep learning as rapidly as possible. And yet that really takes some things, some ways to build trust, some context for the conversation, willingness to hear different views. And I appreciated that they put that front and center. What we're here to do is first create a zone of deep learning and then get people in contact with each other.
This is a new organization, and not only in Kansas, but it really is pretty unique nationwide. And Ed and the organization seem to have this attitude about experimentation. They don't have all the answers, and they're going to try things and experiment and see where it takes them and keep building on what they're learning. So it's a fascinating, interesting place. Must be a great time to be there at the early stages of it as well. And I also was impressed. I think we mentioned this last week, and he talked about it again today. He basically said, we're open source. Our research, what we do here, is available, free and available to anybody to use, and we encourage people to contact the organization. He encourages people to contact him. And, you know, it seems like it's a real learning organization, which I think at this stage of the game, it really has to be.
There was another thing that struck me, Peter, his comment about he used to feel the need to be at every meeting. I know he had some other people handle this, and that, you know, is an important way for him to scale as a leader. And it's certainly a topic that comes up a lot with my executive coaching clients, because you get used to, earlier in your career and as you're moving up, aiming to cover everything and to be there. And there's so much value often to hearing issues directly and bringing in that leadership presence and all that. And it is a real transition for people. At some point, some people pull it off early in their careers, and some, really, they're in CEO level positions and trying to be at every meeting they can possibly be at. It is so valuable for the development of people in their organization, as well as the sanity of the leader, to be thoughtful about, what do I have to do so that other people can be successful at the meetings I used to go to?
As great a job as it seems to be, they realize how difficult, he realizes how difficult the leadership actually is to teach and bring to people. And they're using case in point method, which I don't know if, how much you've worked with that. That can be something that is really takes people out of their comfort zone.
Yes.
And challenges people. And seems like much of their programming there is built around the case in point method.
And one of the things that does is to put the facilitator in a vulnerable spot, the teacher in a vulnerable spot, where they're needing to learn in a real-time way and model openness and communication and all that right as they're in the process of teaching and helping other people learn.
There's a great book called Leadership Can Be Taught by Sharon Deloes Parks, and it's basically a profile of Ron Heifetz, who we've talked about before from Harvard Kennedy School, and it basically takes a semester of one of his courses wherein they use the case in point method, and if you haven't read the book, definitely encourage you. It's a very interesting read. So that was Ed O'Malley. Anybody who is involved in the nonprofit world as a leader, volunteer, or an executive leader should definitely listen to what he has to say in the podcast and then get in touch with him, because he's very approachable. He's interested in what you're doing, and I can guarantee you, you're going to be interested in what the Kansas Leadership Center is doing as well. So what are your final thoughts about leadership this week, Pam?
Well, I had a very interesting experience last Friday with David Kelly of IDEO, founder of IDEO, and some of his colleagues from the D School at Stanford were meeting with folks at Nueva School for the Gifted about how to bake design thinking into K-12. And they're doing some amazing work at Nueva, but also at a variety of economically disadvantaged schools. And it was absolutely fascinating, encouraging, exciting to hear fresh from David Kelly what we can rally together to do. And they're trying to do this initiative as permeably as possible. You can follow the D School on Twitter, and they have now a special Twitter feed for K-12 Ed. And they have a wiki and a Ning and whatever, and it's just a few people. And so they're trying to put up online as much as they can so that other people can actively replicate it. You know, they've also have that permeability, open source sort of approach, and say, hey, please steal these ideas and go use this, and, you know, may 1,000 schools bloom. And I'm looking forward to meeting on Friday with one of the grad students, biochemistry, who is a part of the D School K-12 team, and with Peter Hahn, who is a 15-year-old who founded Inventors Without Borders, and he's coming to meet over at the D School. So I will track that learning, and I'm sure tweet about it.
Great, and maybe report back here.
You bet.
Well, that's another Weekly Leader podcast. We got a couple very exciting interviews coming up, coming weeks, we'll be talking about, and so stay tuned, and Pam, I look forward to chatting with you next week. We would love for you to join us in the leadership conversation, so head on over to the website, which is weeklyleader.net, and find the podcast post and leave us a comment about what you heard here or what you'd like to hear in the future. Over there, you'll also find some amazing posts by our talented team of bloggers who are really passionate about the topic of leadership. So check it out. Find something there that you might want to engage in conversation with them with. They'd love to hear from you. You can always send us an email at podcast@weeklyleader.net. And if you wanted to submit an audio comment, that would be fantastic. Attach a small audio file of 5 megs or less, an MP3 file, and we'll find a way to integrate it into the show. You can always get us on Twitter. Weekly Leader is @WeeklyLeader. Pam is @PamFR. And I'm @PeterMello. That's PeterMello. All of our other contributors' Twitter IDs will also be in the show notes. If you use iTunes, we would really appreciate it if you would rate and review the podcast. We've got a number of really good ratings and reviews, which helps us move up the into the more featured category. So we would really appreciate it if you would check that out and let us know what you think there too. We always use PodSafe music, and this week we use some music from Music Alley, which used to be the PodSafe Music Network. And something we heard on C.C. Chapman's Accident Hash, which is a great music podcast. If you don't listen to it, you should check it out. He played a Howard Jones song. So we're using Howard Jones' Building Our Own Future as the bumper on either side of Ed O'Malley's interview. And finally, we're closing out with another great tune called Revolution of the Heart. We really thank you for investing your time with us, and we look forward to being with you again next week.
Without exception.